Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
John Baldacci said, energy consumption matters both to our environment and our economy. Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest whose company helps both the environment and our economy by reducing energy consumption. Today's Playmakers company has reduced a print and shipping provider's energy consumption by more than 20% with a savings of more than $4 million annually. With us today is CEO, whose company is one of the fastest growing tech companies and was named a Tech Titan by the Dallas Business Journal. This great playmaker is John Boland. John is CEO of Entouch Controls. John is a business-centric technology leader who focuses on disciplined execution. John joined Entouch Controls in 2013 as our Chief Operating Officer and played a critical role in transforming this early-stage energy management and controls organization into a platform as a service offering. Founded in Dallas in 2008, Entouch is the pioneer in energy management with thermostats and software to improve efficiencies for key systems used for buildings. The company provides cloud-based software and hardware that measures and manages areas that include HVAC and lighting, along with the metering of electricity, gas, and water. Named CEO in 2019, John and his team have led Entouch to the most profitable year in its history. Well, John, looks like we'll have a lot to talk about. Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, you were, I understand, a retail brat who disappointed his father by ending up in retail. What's that story about?
Oh, that's fantastic. My dad worked for JCPenney's for 38 years. And not the JCPenney's that those of us who live in North Texas think of as the big building up on the Dallas North Tollway. My dad was a JCPenney men's department manager. He became a JCPenney store manager and spent his entire career as a merchant and as a young boy invited me into this world where I was doing store resets overnight, you know, kind of a pizza party with he and his employees. I for the most part, thought my father owned JCPenney's growing up. I was also one of the first young people in my family to get an opportunity to go to graduate school. And my father told me very early on that I was going to be an attorney. And I was not, under any circumstance, to become a business person and go into retail. That was not something that he saw as actually growing beyond him. He always wanted so much more for me than he felt like he had. And he gave us a wonderful life. Don't get me wrong. I did not grow up as, you know, a poor child in poverty. We were a very, very middle-class family that most families want to achieve. So, sure enough, I do go off to law school and hated just about every minute of it. I was doing everything I could to be a good student, and in fact was in the top 10% of my class. My dad so wanted this as part of his dream that he was paying for law school. And As a young man, realizing that, you know, I just didn't have a passion for this, and I was working so hard, and I was quite frankly spending his money. I was newly married, and realized I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I didn't want to do this. And I'll say a moment of maybe wisdom, but it was a little too young for wisdom. It may have just been just a brief moment of clarity. I decided that I needed to take a break. And I actually went to work for, of all places, Waffle House, and became a short order cook. And
now this is going from studying law to becoming a short order cook in a small Waffle House restaurant.
Exactly, and I was, you know, I wasn't just at any law school. Not that it was I certainly wasn't at Harvard Law, but I was at Emory Law School in Atlanta. So I was at a relatively prestigious school, and within about 48 hours, was flipping eggs. And I had to have this conversation with my father that said, look, I'm not sure what I want to do. I think I may go back and get my business degree. And I honestly think it was one of the most disappointing conversations he'd ever had with me. Because he had put all his chips on me, right? He was at the roulette table, and I was black 27, and he had stuck it all on me. And gosh, I was going to prove to he and his family and people, I mean, my dad's father was a coal miner. And their vision of the American dream was that your children had to be more than you. And here I was, a short order cook at Waffle House, managing a Waffle House restaurant. I'll say it was probably the most formative experience I had from a business perspective, though. I did need to learn to run a business. I was managing a 24-hour operation. I was hiring people and managing cash. I was every bit of 22 years old running, you know, $800,000 to $1 million business. And it allowed me to get some clarity on who I wanted to be. And so I decided to go back and get my graduate degree in business from Emory. But I decided to pay for it myself. And so I went back to my father and I said, I don't know where I'm going to go, but I know that this is what I want to do. And it's really no longer for you to do it. I just want you to be proud of me. He feigned some pride, but was still pretty disappointed, tried to talk me into getting my JD and my MBA at the same time. But ultimately, I graduated top of my class at Emory, and sure enough, I went right to work for a retailer. I went to work for Racetrack Petroleum, and I still remember my dad wanting to be just wildly proud, thinking, all this work, and you're working for a convenience store. What are you doing? And the reality is, I had had a passion for it because it's what he did. It's what he showed me. I could do things, you know, I don't know if I could do things better than my father. I think he built a wonderful, wonderful life for us. But I also didn't want to stray too much from what he had shown me. And so where he was, you know, I'll say moderately disappointed, I just found something that I naturally kind of gravitated to. And so I became the youngest director in Racetrack's history. I became the youngest vice president in Racetrack's history. I was your, you know, for those of you who are as old as I am and remember Family Ties, I was basically Alex P. Keaton, and I was just on my way.
Well, with the training you got in law, I'm sure that has helped you along the way too. But in addition to that, your father had to have been proud of you for doing what you did and going where you went to do what you did.
He really was, right? I lost my father in 06, and you know, one of my greatest regrets is he never saw me become CEO of a company. But I think he knew that it was going to happen, right? He was one of my closest friends, and by the time I had sort of achieved the midpoint of my career, I was running the European business unit for the company I was working for, Radiant Systems. He came over to Prague to spend Christmas with us. And I think that was an experience he never would have had, but for my success. And I think it was at that point for him, it really came home as he looked at, you know, he was a doting grandfather. As he looked at my kids, you know, spending a Christmas in Europe that most people don't get the opportunity to do, and looked around and saw the family that I was building, quite frankly, in the image of his own. I think he was very proud, and he certainly said it many times over the years. I don't think I was quite the disappointment that I lay on.
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. That's A. B, you had to have picked up a lot through osmosis from your dad, as you were talking about, just being around him, that seeped into who you were, and that helped make you successful because of the success that he was.
I think so. I'd like to say I'm a recovering workaholic. But I think there's some people close to me that say, I'm not sure you're in the recovering phase just yet. At least you've gotten past the denial phase. But my father worked 6.5 days a week, 5 days, 12 hours a day. Saturday he worked 6 to 8 hours, and he did it for almost 40 years. And that was that's how you did it. And you put in all of the effort, all of the work. And one of the most important lessons I ever learned from him was kind of teaching accountability and it's a derivative of what I call disciplined execution. So my dad ran a JCPenney store. And every single night, whoever closed the store called him and told him what the day's numbers were. Every single night. It was the last phone call that came into our house between 9 and 9:30 every night as long as I can remember. And my dad was also the first person in the building every single morning. To this day, I am very much an early riser. I wake up every day at about 5 o'clock a.m. I never set an alarm clock. Drives my kids crazy. But my dad was the same way. And so he was in the door at 6 a.m. every single day. And so one night, I'm probably 13, 14 years old. And I said, Dad, I don't get it. You have them call you at 9:30 to tell you the numbers. But they put the report on your desk, and you're the first person in. And that means you can see the numbers the next morning. And he said, oh, I know. I said, well, why do you have them call you? And he said, because I want them to know what they're doing is important. I want them to know that it matters. And I want them to care about what those numbers are. They're not going to care if I don't care. And that was probably the most significant window into how my father led his business. And he was ultimately, you know, for his generation of JCPenney store managers, he was one of the most successful, right? It was back at a time when kind of, you know, in the Sam Walton mold, the managers were merchants. And so my dad really did run his own business. And it wasn't until I was much older that I realized the scale of the business he ran. Right? When he retired, he was running a business that was $60 million in annual revenue with about 450 employees. And I just thought he was a JCPenney store manager. So yes, I learned a tremendous amount from him.
And within that, you used part of the word a few moments ago, but what I heard you talk about was leadership. Mm-hmm. And again, if you picked up everything else from your dad through osmosis, my guess is, and you can talk about this, you also picked up the leadership aspect of your dad in what you're doing, especially in the role of CEO now.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think the answer is absolutely yes. The one I take the most grief for is that my dad was a storyteller. And he would conduct his meetings at Penny's and always have an analogy. There was always a story in order to bring things together. And it became such a vehicle to make meetings longer that he was legendary if he saw someone in the room look at their watch. He would look at them and say, do you have a bus to catch? And I certainly have gotten his sort of gift for storytelling in meetings. My team at NTouch has awarded me the award for person most likely to extend a meeting with a story on multiple occasions. But I think there is a craft in how you use storytelling to help people understand your ideas. And so it also humanizes you as the leader, right? There's this sense of, you know, I'm the boss, and so I get to just say this is what we're going to do. And I'm reading a book, actually, and have been reading Extreme Ownership for a little while, and they talk about an example where the soldiers and people who are reporting up through sort of the hierarchy don't understand the mission and therefore aren't carrying it out. And how, you know, that falls on the leader, not them, right? If your people do not understand your vision or what you're trying to drive, that is not actually their fault. You hired them, you placed them, you told them what the goals were. If they don't understand the goals, it's because you didn't communicate it effectively, which is why I think storytelling can be a great vehicle for helping people understand complex ideas, especially ones that, you know, I'll just say basic words and concepts don't always capture.
Well, you mentioned that in writing to me that you have a passion to fix organizations. Mm-hmm. You've worked for a number of different companies prior to getting to InTouch Control as COO a few years ago. But is that your passion? Do you want to go in and fix it and make it better and keep it growing?
It really is. And what's interesting is, and I've listened to some of your other guests, and I've listened to other people I respect in the business world, certainly read, you know, a library full of books. And, you know, I always felt like I was missing something because I couldn't say, well, this was my calling. And I knew it when I was at 21 or 22. Heck, I was bouncing around law school and graduate business school at 22. And it wasn't until a little bit later in my career, I was actually in Europe, in Prague, and realized that my passion really was to fix organizations, get that job done, and then potentially go on to whatever that next thing was. InTouch has been one of my longest journeys professionally, but I was in Europe. I'm sitting on a balcony at my neighbor's house. He was a U.S. expat also. We're having a drink together. And he says, what do you do? And like any good young business person, I kind of puffed out my chest and spit out my title. You know, I'm the managing director of EMEA for Radiant Systems. And he takes a sip of his drink and looks at me and says, I have no idea what that means. What do you do? And I stopped for a second and realized that I'd spent all this time trying to get a title that I couldn't really articulate effectively what it was I actually did. And stepped back and I thought about how I got to Europe. I actually was working for Radiant in the United States. I was running a large product development group. We were getting ready to release a product into Europe. It wasn't fully tested, and there was no infrastructure on the ground. I walk into the COO's office, and I say, look, this rollout is going to be an absolute mess. It's going to be bloody, and if we don't get some leadership in Europe, this is going to be horrific. In fact, if I thought you'd send me, I'd go. About 8 hours later, I was committing to moving to Europe. And so this conversation is taking place about a year after that, and I said, you know, I came here because we weren't ready and the organization was broken. I guess in the end, it's my job to fix it, and that's really what I do, is I fix organizations so they can perform to really the level that we had envisioned. And of course, my friend was like, well, that's a mouthful, right? You know, and you know, it's a fairly heady kind of answer to someone while you're sharing a glass of whiskey. But what ends up happening is I end up getting Europe kind of stood up. And I want to do something next, but I'm in an organization that doesn't know what to do with expats. They're like, well, we can bring you back to the States, but we'll have to figure out where we put you now. Because we were an adolescent kind of organization. And I get a phone call from a recruiter who represents a software organization and says, hey, I've heard about you. We've got this company. Ownership's trying to sell it, but they've got kind of got a mess. How do you feel about moving to Arizona? Moved to Arizona, and for 2 years, we basically revamped this entire organization, rebuilt the entire product set, and ultimately exited it to a larger organization. One of the bidders who was introduced to me during the process reaches out and says, hey, we have that same problem. And since we didn't buy you guys, how do you feel about coming to, of all places, Des Moines, Iowa, which I happen to love, and do the same thing for us? And that began this journey where I just recognized that that's what I enjoyed, right? I enjoyed understanding why the organization was underperforming. Taking this, you know, sometimes ragtag group of folks, right? You know, Jack Welch wrote about putting the right people on the bus. Well, you know what? That's great when you have a war chest full of funds. Sometimes you just got to take the passengers that are on the bus and make them successful. And you don't get to go hire all new passengers. You have to help them achieve what they didn't think they could achieve. And so that becomes part of the journey. And Touch was sort of the same way. We had helped exit a business, Westech Intelligence Surveillance, to a larger company. I got to know InTouch through, you know, mutual acquaintance, and they had sort of the same problem. You know, it was a founder-led business. They were trying to scale. They'd never been able to build out a managed service organization, and it needed to be fixed in its own way. The really interesting kind of fork in the road is that we fixed it and then began to plateau, and I was given the opportunity to fix something I had already fixed, and that's the role that I'm in now. And we've achieved so much more than we thought we could in just, you know, call it 18 to 24 months. But it's an interesting philosophical dilemma to think that I'm now fixing something that I helped fix in the first place.
Well, you figured out what you do now.
Mm-hmm.
You're a fixer. So let's talk about what InTouch Controls does.
Absolutely.
Talk about that. Talk about why you're so excited in fixing that organization. Because, as I mentioned before we started, this company, with what it does, is this is its time with what's going on in the world right now. So tell us about that and how you help your clients solve their problems.
Well, you know, I'll start with a study that McKinsey did in the last couple of years, which was they looked at investments we could make in sustainability and sustainable technologies, especially with the pressure on organizations now to start thinking in terms of how can I be a better citizen when it comes to the environment. And McKinsey found that the highest return, quickest way to impacting your energy consumption is to look at creating smarter buildings, leveraging controls. And what NTouch does, right, is create smarter buildings with controls. We actually like to say we're saving the planet and increasing your profitability. We just do it one building at a time. But we've created an energy management solution that allows us to very, very easily and relatively inexpensively retrofit an existing building, have all of our controls communicate locally wirelessly, and then we can bring all that information back to the cloud and manage this information from the cloud across an entire portfolio of businesses. So our customers, you know, for folks in the North Texas area, right, include people like JCPenney's, folks like Chuck E. Cheese, right? In a broader sense, right, we're in Lowe's Canada, we're in Aldo Shoes. We're, you know, for the most part, if you're in a multi-site environment, odds are you're probably either one door away from one of our customers or walking into one of our customers. And folks that manage these broad multi-site portfolios, so you think of retailers and restaurateurs, you know, it's one thing to say I know how to manage the energy in one building. But what we're helping them do is develop a strategy to manage energy across 1,000 buildings. And typically the people who are responsible for this within these organizations are understaffed, under-resourced, and really struggling because most investment in these organizations is going to things that are driving top-line revenue, even though a 20% reduction in energy is very dramatic. And so what we're seeing now is as those savings fall to the bottom line and as organizations are pressured to do something different, that there's an increasing and rather exciting level of demand for what we do.
Well, you, I understand, were chasing a lot of logos. In other words, a lot of big companies that you mentioned. You dropped some names a few moments ago. But your focus now is on enabling commercial real estate organizations, mm-hmm. working through them. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I've been, as we talked about the disappointment of my father, I've been in and around retail and restaurant for a long time. And approaching these folks with a new solution can be relatively challenging for a company of our scale. And those deals take a long time for us to close. And you know, it's you know, we joke, I think everybody's used this phrase in and around business, you know, it takes a village, right? And it really does to close an organization that's getting ready to make a $5 to $10 million investment. And what we recognized is if we wanted to grow our business and address a market more rapidly, especially given where we are, you know, as you're describing, sort of the macroeconomic environment is such that right now everybody wants to adopt these types of technologies. Well, I can't just continue to hire salespeople and hope that that helps me grow my business. While we are doing that, what we need is a real force multiplier. And many of these organizations actually outsource their facilities management to commercial real estate operators and integrated facilities management providers. And so we have focused on creating enabling technology for those organizations and creating partnerships with those organizations so that we can leverage their access to the market and their breadth of sales capability to really accelerate our sales. So for the first time in our history in 2020, nearly 50% of our sales as an organization actually came from our partners, as opposed to business that was originally sourced by NTouch and direct salespeople. That's a game changer for us and really will be a vehicle for us to grow much more rapidly and what we're seeing, much more profitably.
So now you have another avenue to go mm-hmm. to increase your business. Well, should someone want to find out more about NTouch Controls, what do they need to do?
Well, you know, the quickest and easiest way is always go to ntouchcontrols.com, E-N-T-O-U-C-H, controls.com, and you can find out all of the information about our solutions. If you want to reach out to me personally, folks should feel free to send me an email at john.bolin@ntouchcontrols.com, or they can find me on LinkedIn, which seems to be probably the easiest thing for most people these days.
And also on the Playmakers Talk Show website, we have your phone number and we have the website too. John, thank you very much for being a part of Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate being part of Playmakers today.
Well, you let us know exactly what it takes to move into the role of being a fixer when you walk into an organization, and that is something that I haven't heard from any guests, so congratulations on knowing exactly what you're doing right now.
Thanks so much.
Well, this has been a terrific show. As we just mentioned, we've been speaking with John Boland. John is CEO of NTouch Controls. Thank you very much for listening to us and joining us today. Join us again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com, and we'll be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.